Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's Writer to Writer podcast series, featuring a conversation between two prominent writers who are big fans of each other's work. This is Sherilyn Parsons, director of the festival. Enjoy the program.
Welcome. Yeah. You will be uplifted, I promise. You will notice that neither of us is Lynn Ullman, and Lynn is not making a dramatic entrance. There's an airline strike in Norway, which has sadly prevented her from coming. But I'm very pleased to be here with Guy Gullikson, who not only is a writer, author of the story of a marriage, but he is Lynn's editor in Norwegian at October, which is a publishing house where he also publishes Carl Ove Knausgård. So we will bring Lynn with us on stage. This is a good time to silence your cell phones. And I'd also like to thank Norla, Norway House, and Zoetic Press for making our conversation possible. As I mentioned, Mr. Gullikson is the author of several works of literature, actually not yet translated, of children's literature, dramatic performances, plays, poetry, and other works of fiction. But the work we're going to talk about today is called The Story of a Marriage, and it's a brief and heartbreaking novel about a couple who are deeply in love and who break apart over an affair they both auto-erotically bring to life in conversation, and then I think probably somewhat, without giving away much, regret that they've conjured it in their conjugal activities. I'll leave it at that. Maybe he'll describe how vivid this book is about sex. But one thing I really like about the book is that it shows how in a marriage candor is not a neutral value. That you can promise in advance truth and candor to each other as a couple. And yet once you come to the point of having to say something difficult and hurtful, it bites. And this book is an extraordinary exploration of what happens when that knife goes in. And it's the story of a man trying to reimagine what happened, to tell the story back to himself, to figure out where it went wrong in the way that a failed or ended relationship often feels a bit like a crime story. You go backwards through the clues to what happened before. And in the course of telling the story to you, the reader, the narrator, John, unrelated to me, by the way, my name's John Freeman, is imagining his ex's point of view. And so he begins thinking sometimes, maybe she was thinking this, maybe she was doing this. And gradually, his wife enters the book as a character. It's a dazzling performance. And it's also, in some ways, part of, and we'll discuss this, a small movement within Norwegian literature that draws autobiographically, to some degree, from the author's life. People call it autofiction. They call it the blurring of nonfiction and fiction. And we can discuss to what degree this book draws from that tradition or is to the side of it. But for now, just join me in welcoming Guy Gullikson.
Thank you.
So since Lynn was supposed to be on with us, let's start with her and her extraordinary book, Disquiet, about her family. I mentioned the trend in autofiction. Was this something authors writing autobiographically that began with Knausgård? Was it building before him? Because there's another writer, Vigdis Hjorth?
Vigdis Hjorth, yeah.
Yeah, who has a book coming out in English translation this fall, who also fits within that. What's happening here?
Well, I is this going okay? Can you hear me? You know, I really don't think this is very new. I think that literature always is very close to life. And In fact, I think that when Karl Ove Knausgård was beginning to write My Struggle, his headache, and maybe also mine, was that it felt that he was in the middle of something that a lot of people were talking about. Because, of course, the brand autofiction has been rising in a way in Norway, but other places as well. But I think one has to draw a line between what literature always does and what is maybe autofiction. Mm-hmm. And of course, when Karl Ove decided to write a novel with actual names on the characters, on everyone that he had met, and not everyone, but a lot of them, you can say that's autofiction in a way. Mm-hmm. But when you read Linn Ullmann writing about a girl with a father that's an old father and a mother that she, well, everyone, I feel like a child now. I wish I could say this in Norwegian, but I hopefully it gets through. For me, Linn's novel is not autofiction in that manner, because you don't have to know her family. You don't have to have seen Ingmar Bergman's movies to read her novel. The characters are being built in the novel, and I think it's not possible to read it as a biography. Mm-hmm. Because it has so many questions, so much that is on the side of imagining and on the side of fantasy.
And she uses various points of view. She writes in first person and in third person and has a kind of system almost. From a distance, childhood, for example, is often seen in third person. Whereas when the narrative goes back to the present tense, basically a woman has found a group of tapes of interviews with her famous filmmaking father, and it calls her back to the summers that she spent with him on an island with eight other half-siblings. And so part of the book is her remembering those incidences, and then she shifts into third person, and then part of the book is in first person, about going back to that time, and deals with a present tense marriage. And it was a very sophisticated use of narrative space. And I think perhaps that is one quality that we should say lends towards the novelistic, maybe. Is that the case? Do you find that when something is arguably a work of fiction, it uses more artifice to create its dream, if you will?
Yeah, I agree, and I also think that how should I say this? It's for most writers, it's important that you are able to one time in your life at least to write about your parents. But if you have parents that are famous, like Linn has, it's another story, you know, and it took her a very long time to get to write this novel. Mm. But the parents are never named as Ingmar Bergman and Liv Ullmann. So I think it asks for the reader to be read as a novel. And of course, a lot of us can't forget that we think that we know something about our parents. Mm. But that is also the case in a lot of other novels, you know?
We'll get to yours in a second. But, you know, if you travel at all within editorial circles, I'm just going to pronounce his name the English way, Gehr, is sort of legendary because Knausgård didn't sort of write in a shack by himself with no one saying, maybe you should do this, maybe you should, you know, in his head, he was actually in constant contact with you, and you were going back and forth about the shape of the book and telling, giving him advice about which direction to go. And in that sense, you're sort of the legendary cut man in the corner, to use a boxing metaphor. And I wonder, was that unusual for you? Did you have that same kind of relationship with Lynn as she was beginning to write Unquiet?
Well, yes, I started to work with Lynn. My first book came on when I was 22, and when I was 30, I started as a publisher. And Lynn was this fantastic critic, the most important critic in Norwegian literature at that time. So I didn't imagine that she would write novels at all, but I wanted her to write about literature. And she said, I don't know, but I have two short stories. Can you read them? And from then on, we started working together. And I, you know, I don't think that I really give advice in that way you said it. It doesn't feel like I give advice because nobody. I don't think that editors should give very strong advice, because if you start to give very strong advices about what a writer should do, you in a way get very conservative, because all you know is what you have read before. Mm-hmm. And the very interesting thing with a writer is what this writer can do that nobody else has done. Mm-hmm. So I think the most interesting thing to do is to read something and to hopefully to be able to find what seems most alive in what you read. And this is what I try to do with Karl-Ove and also with Lynn. Mm. And try to take on it and talk about it. What's happening here? Something is happening here, and it's very interesting. And from that point, it's possible, often, not always, for a writer to develop some kind of writing that hasn't been done in that way before.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the literary culture right now in Norway. Before we began, Guy was talking about the middle class, because he's writing a book on the Norwegian middle class. You may know that Norway has the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world, and it's basically 1-2% of that is taken off every year for the government and for social services and things like that, and the rest is saved from their oil and gas deposits. So this extraordinarily huge pile of money has basically created an enormous new middle class. And I wonder if you can talk about the effect of that on literature, because through history, reading and the novel in particular develop with the rise of a middle class very often. Mm. And is there something happening in Norwegian literature in the last 30, 40 years that feels related to the vast decrease in rural poverty that Norway had lived under for so long?
Mm. That was a very big question, you know.
Just 145 characters or so. Yeah.
Yes. I'm not writing a book about middle class. I'm writing about a book about middle class. And what's very interesting with the middle class in Norway is that we have a very strong culture for no one wants to be a part of the elite. Everyone wants to be, you know, normal. And that's it might be like that other places as well, but I think it's very, very strong in Norwegian culture. And that makes the situation with literature were a bit odd, because in this book that I'm writing about, they have asked people, what do you read? What kind of authors do you like to read? And would you say that Dag Solstad is a better writer than someone who is, writing love stories in a way, you know? And a lot of these people who are, they are doctors, they are architects, they are, you know, the upper middle class. They say it's wrong to say that one book is better than another. And this, I think, is quite special in Norway. And it's one of my headaches, in a way. And I think we have, and it's getting worse in a way. As you know, we had a very strong literary tradition in Scandinavia with the crime novels. And when that started, no one would say that a crime novel was an important piece of fiction. Mm-hmm. But now you are very arrogant if you try to say that it's not. So things have been changing for those years, not to the better, I would say. I'm not against crime at all, but I think that it's true that Dag Solstad, which is an old Norwegian novelist, is a better writer than most of the crime novelists. And I, all the crime novelists that I know would say that's true. Mm. But in this study of the middle class, it's obvious that people are getting angry in a way if you try to say that some literature are better than other kinds of literature.
Hmm. I bring this up because the main characters in this book, John and his partner, Ryan, does she actually get named?
Yeah, she's named after Jimmy. She's named after the Jiminy figure in the Disney.
Yeah.
So, but in Norwegian, it's Timmy.
Yeah, so yeah. John and Timmy are new entrants, if you will, to the middle class. They're the first in their families to go to university. Timmy is a doctor. John is a journalist and writer. They're living on borrowed credit. They're sort of living beyond their means, but not without a lot of anxiety about ever paying for the lifestyle that they are living in. When they meet, John is married and Timmy is single, and John very quickly, abruptly, somewhat ruthlessly, leaves the mother of his first child for Timmy. And as the story begins, what happens in the rest of the story has already happened, and John is looking back, trying to tell the story of this relationship, and throughout, little flashes of social context are put in there, and I don't want to read the characters as sociological documents, but talk, if you will, a little bit about where this couple would fit within the Norwegian society you just described and its social vectors.
Well, I'm the first one in my family to go to high school. I was the first in my family then to study at the university. And the same is the case with those two characters in a way. It has been, as in a lot of countries, I think, a kind of democratization of knowledge that more people are studying than before. Especially in Norway, because we are much richer now than we was when I was a child. Still, when I was a child, in the end of the 60s, we were quite poor country in a way that changed during the 70s mostly and the 80s. I think it's very interesting to write about those kind of people who have made this journey from from quite simple upbringing, and who they go to university and they earn money and they can live in a way that their parents couldn't dream of that they should. It makes you feel privileged in a way, but it can also make you a bit spoiled. And I think a lot of people in Norway are a bit spoiled. Mm. I feel a bit spoiled myself. When I came to Berkeley and saw the people living on the streets, I feel a bit spoiled. Something's wrong.
We think that here too.
Yeah.
I would say a third of this book takes place between the sheets or bent over a surface or in a shower or in various formations in which two human bodies can fit. And one of the interesting evolutions as John retells the story of his marriage is how in the beginning he and Timmy are completely and utterly satisfied with each other in that Congress, as in they don't need to narrate it. They don't need to look at a mirror at what they're doing. They are simply together and doing that wonderful, you know, thing that you do when you're in love, which is you lose track of time. But as the novel goes on, you watch as they make love and need increasing amounts of mediation and fantasy. To some degree, I feel like this is as much a novel about marriage as it is about choice.
Mm.
Because as their narration increases, so much of it revolves around choice and lack thereof. The games that they play about her being forced, the games he plays about narrating what would happen if he was out of the house and he came in and she was with another man. Are you looking at choice in this novel as a kind of Pandora's box, socially and intimately, in the context of a marriage? Is it something that you have to put to the side and not think about? Because once you start talking about it and thinking about it, you've let some dark water into the room?
Mm. I would prefer to hear you answer that question because I'll... but I understand I have to do it in a way. I'm very, very shy. It's possible to see it now when I try to speak English, but it's not usually possible to see it when I speak Norwegian because I'm a grown man, and as a grown man I can hide my shyness. And I think I've written at least three novels the last years with a lot of sexuality. I don't know why. and the worst part of it is being on the stage and talking about it, you know?
This is California, man. It's all good.
Yeah. but I'm still shy. but I think what happened was that I discovered two things mainly. It was that, if you as a writer ask one of your fellow writers or your publisher or something, if you say, I would like to write a novel with a lot of sex in it, they would say, please don't do it. Because it's very, very difficult. And it's very embarrassing, of course, especially when it's not good. But in a way, I realized that I had to do something that felt very difficult. And I think that as a quite grown man and a writer, I am quite happy that I realized that, because you have to find something that feels like it's impossible to write about this, mm-hmm. and then try to do it. Sometime in your life you have to do that. Mm. And the other thing I realized was that if you want to write about love, since I was a child, I have been feeling I don't identify with my identity as a man. It doesn't mean that I would like to be a woman. It feels like a very strange thing to choose between, you know. But when I was 13 or something, it was the International Women's Year, and that was the time that I realized that I'm on the wrong side, you know, as a man. As I was growing up to be a man, and I knew that I understood that men was, you know, having privileges that men women didn't have, and it just felt like it explained something for me how I felt that I wouldn't be the kind of man that I saw around me when
Some
I was a
might
child.
People applaud you for that, though.
Well, and now I don't understand why I said it at all. But I think I was going to. Why did I say that? I don't know.
This book is also, you know, if it's not about choice, it's certainly about masculinity.
Yeah.
And at some point, two-thirds of the way through, some of the sex games that John is playing with Timmy begin to involve increasing amounts of humiliation.
It's true.
And he narrates his eventual humiliation as part of their sex. He also then doubles back on himself when he's alone and thinks, it's going to fail because I've made myself weak. And it's very clear throughout the book that John doesn't subscribe to traditional notions of dominant, toxic masculinity, if we want to put it some way or other. And it feels like one of the things that perhaps, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that makes this book anxiety-making to talk about is less the fact that people have sex. I assume everyone in this room has at some point had sex. Mm-hmm. We're all together in this. It's not that awkward. But it's rather the vulnerability that he takes on in this role that feels shameful. And I wonder if you can talk about that shame in the context of vulnerability and masculinity.
I think what I wanted to come to was that when I started to write novels for real, in a way, in 2009, I think I started to write about sexuality and love. And love is, you know, if you write about heterosexual love, that is the place where sexuality is the place where love is visible, in a way. And after a while, I realized what a lot of people have realized before me, that love has a great deal to do with power. You know, just any simple, innocent embrace is about power, in a way. Because one of us is embracing and the other one is, at first at least, the one being embraced. And those kind of I feel that a lot of what's going on in our love life and in our sexuality, in fact, is not being talked about so very much.
This is what I love about your book, is it's not using, in any case, ever pornographic language about sex, which is very empty. It's using the sex as a visible contact sheet for the tiny gradations and the shifts of power between the couple that we're watching in front of us. And so at some point, Timmy is more visibly open to taking on submissive positions, when in fact in the relationship she is gaining more power. And her ability to be submissive is dependent on the growth in her power within the relationship. And it's that kind of dynamic that the book churns around. And I wonder if in the publication of this book if the discussions have differed, because this book was published in France. It's been published here, it's published in Norway, and I assume in some other countries. And I wonder if the discussions about power and intimacy and sexuality have differed at all in any of the places. Because you've published this book in the year of, in this country, of Me Too. And so there's all these discussions on power are incredibly visible and necessary, but also everywhere. And so it changes the way that a room moves when you say the word power.
In Sweden and in France, the novel has been read and discussed as a, I wouldn't say a feminist novel. I would say a feminist novel, but it has been discussed together with feminist topics, you know, and I'm very happy about that. In Norway, not at all, and it's quite interesting. And I feel more at home in the discussion about feminism, and it's something that this. Main character, the male main character, I think you can talk about him in two ways, because he's, as you say, he's quite tender and he's able to humiliate himself, maybe too much, but still he's trying to be very understanding when his wife is falling in love with another man. But there's also another way to read him and to talk about him, and that's a man that's, he is the one telling the story, he is the one imagining what's happening with his wife, and he is, in a way, you know, invading also in their life, invading her fantasies, her sexual fantasies, and he's, in a way, you know, I think he's pushing his wife away and
absolutely.
But those kind of discussions were very, very interesting and very easy to have in Sweden and in France. I've seen the same. I haven't been in France with the novel, but I've seen what they wrote. But not in Norway, because in Norway we had.
Do you want me to bring up the context?
Well, come on.
So, in the middle of the publications of books like My Struggle, Unquiet, Vigdis Horst's book, and your book, one particular Norwegian critic created a kind of ethical optic test for judging works of fiction based on the number of and actuality of so-called collateral damage. So she was basically a self-appointed investigator of the actual characters behind characters in books, and was criticizing, I think, books like yours specifically. You responded in the newspaper Morgenbladet, and I wonder if you can, that's my capsule summary of it, but I wonder what your response was. Because the last time I was in Norway, we sat down at dinner and this was all we talked about, was this critic's kind of Jeremiad at Norwegian literature, trying to find people who were using and exploiting real people, as if that's the most important. Well, anyway, what was your response in the paper?
you know, this discussion in Norway has been very strange, I think, because it's so easy to, when you write in a big paper, it's so easy to raise emotions, and anybody can feel that if you say that, oh, he's writing about his former wife, and he's writing about sexuality. I think anybody would think, oh, that's not a good thing to do, isn't it? It feels like something you shouldn't do. And I think the same, that I think most writers think very much about what you feel able to write about. And at the same time, writing literature is about life, and you don't have very much else than your experiences. Something I tried to say in the article you are referring to is that I realized, I think quite early, that if you want, you know, I'm a publisher, I read a lot of not very good novels that never will be published, and a lot of them are written because the writer wants to, at least once in your life, to tell your own story the way you would tell it, and at once in your life to be the one that are on the winning side in a way. And a lot of those novels are also written as a kind of a revenge or something. And what I realized very early is that, as I think Roland Barthes wrote, that as a writer you can't have the last word. You can't have the last word. And you can't, if you try to write something where you are defending yourself, it has to be a bad novel. It can't be good. At least I couldn't write in that way. So it's much more interesting to go to the other way, because I think writing is very much about, and this is a very difficult word for me to say in English. In Norwegian, I would say sårbarhet, and you say vulnerable.
Vulnerability.
Exactly. Yeah. It's. I can't say it. I'm sorry. My English teacher is not here. I'm glad for that. I do not think she's alive anymore. But say it once more.
I have trouble with it too. Maybe that's a sign. Calling Dr. Freud. Vulnerability.
Yes.
Yeah, vulnerability. Yeah.
It's a very difficult word. But it's the only thing that's important, I think, when you write. Because if you try to write and try to convince yourself that you are a very good writer, you won't have anything of that stuff, you know? You have to feel a bit alone, and you have to feel that that you don't know anything about what you are writing. So that's what I'm seeking, and that was what I was trying to write an article about when this discussion was going on.
There's a book by an American literary critic and novelist and sometime journalist named David Shields called Reality Hunger. It's a short book written in 800 short chunks. Kind of a manifesto. It was published about 10 years ago, and in it he argues that the conditions of what we agree upon as reality today and how they are made has produced in storytellers and readers a hunger for more reality in their work. And this is before Rachel Cusk wrote her Outline trilogy and Carl Ove's books came out. And I pulled out a quote in there that relates to something you just said, and he writes, candor is key, being willing to say what no one else is willing to say. And I wonder to what degree, you spoke a little bit about the increasing but unacknowledged middle class in Norway. And I feel like one way that middle classes express themselves is through their shock and their offense. I mean, this is what bourgeois sensibilities in France, for example, developed out of. Is shocking the bourgeois, is allows the bourgeois to express their values. And I wonder to what degree you're conscious of either wanting to shock the reader or producing shock for the value of creating that peculiar space that exists between a reader and a text.
I think I especially at one point, were intently working on shocking myself first and then possibly the reader, and that was not the sexuality in itself, but the man's willingness to be humiliated, and I, you know, I traveled a lot with this novel and been speaking to people, and a lot of especially grown men tend to be quite angry at this this character.
At John?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, because, and I understand it, because they say, why does he do that? Why does he fantasize with his wife about her being with another man and things like that? And that was maybe one of the places where I knew that I had to try to go as far as possible. I'm not quite sure why, but I think it creates. I hope it creates an understanding of masculinity and how fragile the masculinity is, because the last, let's say, 100 years, being a woman has changed very much. Being a man hasn't changed very much, and what remains is that men tend to feel humiliated and not manly enough very, very quick, you know. So that was something that I wanted to explore in the novel.
God, Brett Kavanaugh is flashing through my head, and I'm trying to get him out of it. It's like, please get out of it. This is a very rich territory, and I we're getting close to the end of our time together. So I think while we wrap up our discussion, please think of questions you might like to ask, because I think this type of one of the things I liked about the book is. John, he does all the shopping, he does all the cooking, he works at home, he's at home waiting for his wife to come home, and it's not clear when their relationship breaks down which part of what he has been doing is truly submissive. And that confusion cuts to the core of, I think, what you were just talking about with masculinity, because he has basically not only become the kind of middle-class man that his family never would have recognized to some degree. He's also become the kind of man that no one would recognize. and is that in his life, to your reading as him as a character, is that related to the sexual fantasies, or are they just simply adjacent and forgive the pun, rubbing up against each other?
I think that... I think of this as a novel about love. I think that he's a character that he's very afraid of losing his wife. Mm. And if you are very afraid of losing someone, you tend to go there very quick, you know. If you're very, very afraid of something, you tend to create it in a way. Mm. And when he is... understanding that she might be attracted to another man, it will be a very low feeling to be jealous. He doesn't want to be jealous, and the other side of being jealous, you know, is to try to understand what's happening. And I, several times I've spoken to people that has been, especially women that has had men that are having something on the side. Is that understandable?
Absolutely.
Yes. And several of them have been talking about how you don't want to be fascinated by what's happening, and you don't want to be fascinated by that other woman. But that's what can happen, and that's what's happening with John. Mm. He's, because that's the other side. You know, in jealousy is very interesting, I think. Jealousy is a kind of a literary machine, because if you are jealous, you are having a very strong fantasy. You are able to understand and know what's going on in another house. Mm. You can be quite sure now something is happening. So it's almost like literature, you know? And even John, then, when he's trying not to be jealous, the force in jealousy that is fascination overcomes him in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, jealousy is also, all fiction has to escalate. There's, you know, if a piece of writing doesn't escalate, it's not fiction. It's sort of static. And jealousy also, it's like a fire. It seeks oxygen to burn more. And so in addition to making you into a kind of, you know, imaginary time traveler where you can see through walls and into other spaces and back in time to what happened yesterday when she came home late, jealousy also is, it just seeks ways to feed itself.
Yeah.
And watching that overcome John is, it's kind of terrifying because he's fighting it. He's fighting it with his reason. He's fighting it with her. They're talking about it as it's overcoming him. He's fighting it with his family. He's doing more and more with the kids, and yet still it wins. And it's fascinating, is putting it mildly. We've come to the end of our time to talk to each other. I suspect I feel like I should say this is all the time we have. Let's talk about this next week. You've been amazingly frank and open with us, and I appreciate that. But if you have any questions for him about Norwegian writing, his book, working with Lynn, anything, yes, in the back.
I don't know. I'm curious about the book that you're writing about the Norwegian middle class, and I was wondering if this is a novel or nonfiction, and where you are with that, because I'm quite curious about what's happening in Norway.
Yeah, I'm not good enough in English because I'm not writing a book about the middle class. I would love to do it, but I'm writing an article about a book about the Norwegian middle class. and reading this book is quite shocking, I feel. Excuse me?
What's the book?
Well, it's a sociology study, and it's called The Norwegian Middle Class. And what's most shocking, I think, is to read what I tried to speak of earlier, that no one wants to be an elite, and that makes people very afraid of judging anything as not as good as anything else. And, you know, it shocks me because I came into the middle class as an adult. I come from a home where it wasn't much reading. For me, coming into middle class, for me, has been a way of liberating myself from a certain kind of masculinity where men doesn't speak, and if they speak, they shall not be, you know, vulnerable. I made it, and that's just one example. And another example is that I found literature by myself, And it's very, very, very important to me. So, and that's described in this study as well. Because people who come not from the middle class will tend to take the old values from the middle class more, they are more important to people like me than other people who, you know, have been growing up with a lot of books in their home. They can say it's not important. For me, it's very, very important.
Hi, I have not read your book, so my question is very general, and please don't take it as a criticism, but I want to explore a little bit more the relationship between fiction and nonfiction, which seems like an area that you kind of live in a lot in your work, not only as a writer, but as an editor. So to get back to the criticism of your book, from what I understand, your ex-wife complained that she was kidnapped, as she put it, by the book, and that you refused to engage with her about this and respond to it. That's what I read. So I'm curious to understand your reason for that, and does that have to do with the fact that you feel that you've written fiction and therefore you should not have to, you know, defend how you describe the characters or whatever? But I also wonder if that's a bit of an easy way out in that particular realm of fiction that is very autobiographical. And I'm asking that as I happen to be a documentary filmmaker, and in our value system, it's always very important to think about how will the film affect the people in it once it comes out into the world, and, you know, do we need to protect them in some way? Yeah. So with this kind of autobiographical fiction, is there some responsibility of the writer to think about what's going to be the effect on people that are just thinly veiled in the book?
Did you say thinly veiled?
Thinly disguised. You know,
thinly disguised, that yes.
And you live in a small country, so people know everybody. And
oh, people it's not feel, so small, but okay.
well, but what I mean is if a lot of people read the character in the novel as your ex-wife, then would you have some kind of responsibility? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand what you're talking about, and I perfectly agree that anyone making any kind of work, either as a documentarist, as you are, or as a fiction writer, as I am, have a responsibility. I really think that I have a responsibility. And this novel is not at all a thinly disguised story of my life or my former marriage, but I struggle wherever I go to convince people that that's not the case. And I published this book in 2015, and I rest my case in a way. But I really agree with you, and I thought about it a lot because, of course, there are experiences and even scenes from my own life in the novel. But one of the things I was thinking about was that I thought that, you know, the 40 or 50 people that read books and know my former wife and me that would think that this was a thinly disguised story about us. I wanted to make sure that if they wanted to believe that, they would at least think that the idiot in the story was the man. So I put a lot of energy in making the man a kind of, not the man I wanted to identify with. And of course, I did other things. I spoke to my ex-wife and told her that this novel might be read as a story about you and me by the few people we know. And she didn't react, and I gave her the manuscript. So the reaction came 1 year after, when the discussion in Norway was very high and bitter about a lot of other novels. And she's not here, so I think I'll just end it there. Yeah. But I really agree. But what I do not... What concerns me in the discussion in Norway is that it's so easy to make people believe that a work of fiction is really not a work of fiction. That it is, as you said, thinly veiled or thinly disguised. I think a lot of people who have tried to write fiction will know that you will have to come near your own experiences, but somehow they will have to change. They will have to change. They change in ways that I don't understand why, but they do. And I thank you for your question.
I think there was one over here in the striped shirt.
Hi, I have actually two questions. One, I just wanted to, you're the Gief that Knausgård talks a lot about. You're his dear friend who, he talked a lot about you in the books. Are you the same?
Should I answer that first?
Yeah.
You know, in his books, there are three persons named Geir. One of them is a friend of his. And he's quite, I think he's quite extreme in a way. He has very extreme opinions. I don't like him.
Was that the childhood friend?
No, it's not the childhood friend. It's the one that he wrote, he read everything he wrote for this friend every day or something. The other one is an old publisher. And the third one is me. And people tend to think that I'm the friend with those peculiar opinions. You know, you can't defend yourself against that either. Thank you for asking.
One more thing. I was talking to someone today, and because what you said I thought was very interesting about how men haven't really changed in the past 100 years, but women have changed hugely. You know, the expectations of women for their lives, and also expectations for men's behavior. It's all changed very quickly. And anyways, who I was talking to said that he thought our election of Trump and possibly the worldwide, right-wing thing is kind of like a reaction to feminism. It's kind of a reaction, you know, unconscious male fear of this rising tide of women's consciousness as characterized by the Kavanaugh incident, because most men in their lives have probably at one point threatened a woman in some way. So it just kind of unleashed this tide of fear in men, and that's why we have Trump. just a theory. I don't know. Thought about it.
Yeah. I shouldn't say anything about Trump, I think. but I agree with you. I think it's a very interesting thought, and I think it's true that the masculinity is very fragile, and that makes men, some men, a bit dangerous, of course. So the main thing to focus on, I think, is to make men stronger, not in the, you know, the banal and old way of thinking about what's strength, but being mentally stronger and able to relate to themselves and their emotions in a more openly way, if that's an answer.
That's a great... Oh, sorry, there's a question right here.
Yeah, thank you very much for the discussion. I was interested, you know, in what you were talking about concerning the middle class and how it seems that one cannot have an opinion about, you know, literary works. They all have to be kind of in this narrow band of equality. And I'm just wondering if that narrow band extends into other, you know, places in Norwegian society, and if perhaps the sexuality that's expressed, these different power dynamics that rise and fall, is an attempt to maybe to get outside that band, that zone that feels like some kind of entrapment. It's a way to express this, you know, physicality, this emotionality that maybe seems to be suppressed within the middle class of Norway.
That was a very interesting question. I'm not quite sure if I'm able to answer it. I think that Norwegian middle class is quite conservative. It's also quite conservative regarding what one thinks about men and women. It's more conservative than you should think it is. Because, on a lot of ways, we are able to. We have laws and economy that makes it possible for women to work in a way that they can't other places, and they are getting. I have 5 children. I have been home with most of them more than their mothers, at least the last 3 of them. And that's possible because of the laws. But when the middle class is talking about men and women, they tend to talk as if something has gone too far. Not like Trump does, I think, but in a way. And I don't know if this is a question to what you said, but at least it's a problem. Would you like to specify your question more, or is that what we...
It sounds to me that maybe... I haven't read the book, so, and I don't know that much about Norwegian society, but just from what you were talking about, it seems to be a little repressed, and or at least you cannot express, you can't express a hierarchy. Everything has to be kind of the same. You know, all literary works are equally good. So given that, you know, static environment is the sexuality in the book, an attempt to get beyond that, you know, static feeling that exists and express power in ways that feel exhilarating and, you know, and to break through what seems to be a kind of a societal repression.
Yes. I'm really not sure. As when John talked, I just wanted to hear you talk more than myself.
I'm thinking of this passage. Once the affair is not yet begun, but it's imminent, and they sleep together, and we lay beside each other, and I whispered in her ear all the things I wanted to do. She had always liked that. My words could always make her come, and now she said, excuse my language, can't we just fuck? And I said, right away? And she said, yes, an ordinary Norwegian fuck. And then we did it, or rather, I did it to her. She lay on her back without moving, and it goes on to describe that. And I put this note in the margin, and I said, ask what a Norwegian fuck is. So maybe that cuts to what you're describing.
I think it does.
Just for those of us who might be curious, what is a Norwegian fuck?
I'm afraid you have the same. I was just having fun.
Okay, on that note, on having fun, you've been great fun and very warm, and thank you for your candor, and thank you for your questions, and the books are outside. Gary will sign them, we send our best to Lynn, and if you get a chance, please check out Unquiet. It's a beautiful book.
It's a really beautiful novel, yeah. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.